it stopped at 10 in verbal highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. The guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
Welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast podcasted weekly from a kitchen bench in Kingston, Auckland, New Zealand. My name's Lewis, and I'm the host of said show. And if you're new, I chat to people about stuff, man. Every week, I chat to them about stuff, about their stuff, about the world's stuff, about some of my stuff, just stuff. So welcome to the Stuff Talking Podcast. And I talk stuff this week with Paul Walsh, not only a talented individual, deeply creative man, but a dear friend as well. I'll get to chatting about him in a second. But I first wanted, I've had some food for thought over the last week or so in terms of the viewing and the listening diet. I watched this week, amongst other things, Hypernormalization, which is the new Adam Curtis joint, the new BBC show from thinker and scholar and documentary maker Adam Curtis, and an interesting mix of a kind of dystopian perspective on where we are at the moment with our sort of attitude towards power, government, but also attitude towards agitating for any kind of change as well. He posits basically in the doco that since around the 70s that governments and financiers and so on and also technological, what he calls technological utopians, have given up on the real world and realized it's easier to present us with a fake world run by corporations and kept stable by politicians, and that essentially we know this world's fake. We know what we're being told by politicians a lot of the time these days is simply not true. You know, we're a developed thinking society in that way. But at the same time, we just kind of go meh and pretend like everything is okay. But then he introduces a sort of another narrative into the film that we express rage now through clicks on things like Facebook, and that the algorithms have been perfected on Facebook and so on, social media, such that we only see and hear what we like, and then we rage out against things we don't like. We don't see the perspective of the people who like the things we don't like. and as we click, rage click, and consume only what we like and know, social media companies obviously benefit, and also their coders and so on make their algorithms consistently more designed to serve us. It's a lot to take in, but the punchline is kind of that he posits that, how do I put this? He posits that we do occasionally organize things like protests, but they don't form into movements like they used to, or people don't commit to movements like they used to. And it actually reminded me of when there was that Women's March in Auckland that happened all over the world. And it was a great thing. People went, that's fine, and so on. And it was about more than women, of course, the narrative of the protest. But then it was kind of like, I noticed at the time too, I didn't crystallize this until watching the doco, that it was kind of a flash mob in a way. Like, people were sort of happy they'd gone and patted themselves on the back, and then everyone went back to clicking and liking and clicking on Facebook, and nothing really came from it. Oh dear. And then I listened to the current number one ranked podcast in the world, S-Town, which, without spoilers and so on, deals with a very compelling gentleman from the south of America who you at first think is going to be a sort of a cliched redneck. Turns out to be very well read, articulate, the thinker. And amongst that, he has also an extraordinarily dystopian view of the world Mainly he's worried about things like climate change and so on. And I don't know, those two things in particular really came together for me as sort of like, am I doing this? I think I kind of am, although I made a decision not to to just sort of rage post and so on about Trump and the state of that. You know, and I was like, what am I really doing to execute any kind of change or agitation in the world? And I kind of eventually came to the fact that it's a lot of what I like about my job, about teaching, is I do have the opportunity to do that. I'm not saying that as a bailing out my conscience clause. I'm sort of, what am I saying? I'm freaking out about the world. Other people are freaking out. It's good that people are freaking out on large scales, like a 2 hour and 40 minute Curtis Docco. He comes highly recommended, by the way. Are we complacent? Are we you know, slaves to the machines? Is democratic government a model that needs changing? I think I'd answer yes to that, but who stands up to change it? Do we just keep voting every 3 years, not believing anything will happen? Oh, that's right. He also posited that that we don't have politicians now. We have kind of villains who we rage against. And I thought about the way people in the left in New Zealand really did that with John Key. Of course, Trump's the obvious villain. Oh, it goes so deep. I hope I've given it justice and my concerns justice. Anyway, chin up. Chin up. I think I'm halfway through if I have a good run. Maybe I should just keep selfishly clicking and liking and doing things for myself. Yeah, individualism comes up in the doco too, and where individualism comes from. Fascinating stuff. Talk to Paul, more philosophizing. We actually philosophized about internet use before I'd seen that or listened to S-Town. A great chat, really what I like the spirit of the podcast to be. We kind of non sequitur cover Paul's background and what he's doing at the moment with his art and other projects, but we just sort of talk smack about things that worry us and make us laugh and do other things to our emotional strengths. I think we mentioned we joke about how our dads left when we were three or four. Mine left, my folks split. It's just that he was entirely dysfunctional from there on in, probably beforehand. So it's kind of like the same thing as leaving, right? It's that heroin habit and armed robberies and lots of my life in jail. okay, with that, let's go over the desk with Paul. Like the show Verbal Highs podcast on Facebook. There's been people liking, new people every week, lovely. Verbal Highs on Twitter. My emphasis on all this social media malarkey at the end, Adam Curtis, social media, is please, well, it's not really social media, it's iTunes. Go on the old iTunes and give us a star rating, please. They're really important. Subscribe to the show on iTunes and give me a star rating. And even write a review if you want. Hey, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Walsh.
This is Dr. Tannen's Verbal Highs.
Yeah, I was taught, I was, because we didn't have a car when I grew up, so I was taught to, like you... Have you been taught to, like, you line up your...
Oh, yeah, no, I can do it. I can do it quite well. Yeah. But I just don't like doing it.
Yeah, yeah, I was trying to think...
It stresses me out too
much. I was the same until...
Yeah, when you line up the wing mirrors, you look down and you see their wing mirror or something, there's a certain maths to it.
Well, no, it's not, like, so just you line up your wing mirror with theirs.
Yeah.
And then, hang on, so it's that way. And then you go out to 45 degrees.
Yeah.
And then hard lock left. And then in... And then hard lock right and then in.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. I didn't master it until I got a driving job where I had just fucking had to do it.
Right. And I was always quite good at it. I had my first ever, when I did the restricted bloody test, he made me do the most insane reverse parallel park. And I did it. And he was like, I did not think you would do that, mate. And I think I actually...
For the actual test?
Yeah, for the actual test.
Because that's part of the test. It used to be in Wellington.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's Wellington one.
You seem quite tall. How come you're so elevated?
Hello. I'm on a big seat, maybe?
Yeah. You seem just higher up than... Mm-hmm. How tall are you?
I'm 6 foot exactly. I'm like a ruler for 6 foot.
You don't...
182 centimetres.
You don't seem that tall.
I don't carry myself like a tall person.
How does that work?
I don't know. Some people act tall. I don't believe I act at all.
You're that's, look how much lower this is.
Yeah. I will hunch more when I relax.
They're not ergonomically the best, Right.
Had some good links with the people. And you know, Mikey Havoc owns one of my paintings. His partner is a very good friend of mine from from high school.
Oh, really?
Georgia. Yeah.
So she's a bit younger?
Yeah, she is. She's my age.
Oh, this is amazing. I mean, these podcasts sound fine.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's so noisy outside there during the day. This is the first time I can hear the echo in the room in these. Mm. But obviously, like, you've listened, you can't notice today. They sound fine.
Oh, some of the ones I listen to sound fucking terrible. Something supposedly professional.
I thought you meant mine.
No.
Get out!
No. I was listening to one of the political ones the other day. I think just the NPR politics ones. And sure, they churn out like 3 a week.
Yeah.
But one of them was like, are you sitting in the fucking library? Are you on your lunch break with a dictaphone or something?
Yeah, well, that was one of the first things, just to get like, I mean, this all goes down to 64K mono.
Mm.
But I quickly learned with a bit of research that
the quality going in what makes you take quality, yeah.
And we're not, you know, this isn't a Kanye track, really. So it's just as long as dealing with.
Don't use him. He's okay, terrible.
Okay. But what I'm saying is this: okay, this isn't, you know, it's not a big New York 36 channel stereo production. If you catch a speech well, it sounds fine.
The last Kanye album actually had some audio engineers shitting themselves. The Life of Pablo had some moments in there that were like, that should not be released on a label.
Why? What happened? Did he not?
Just really badly mastered samples. Like, they were popping right out and they were like digitally clipping. Like the Metallica album Reload, they had the same problem with that. Metallica were like dragged over the coals for releasing a very poorly mastered album, which was digital clipping, because they had it too loud in the process.
Before we start with that, have you noticed, because you're actually out DJing all the time and I'm not, so I had that gig the other night, and I don't know whether it's a Serato update thing or what, but suddenly tracks are loading too loud and they clip. You actually have to turn the volume back. Like, so my speakers here and all my setup will be at a completely respectable volume, and I'll play a new tune, and for some reason it's loaded into Serato like that.
I quite
and
often
it'll go like that, it'll actually make these sound like they're.
Yeah. I quite often hit it up by mistake, and I'm not entirely sure how I do it. And I think sometimes if you have the volume on a track up loud, the next time you load that track in there,
no, this
the
is new tracks lately that have been loading.
Yeah,
up.
So I think maybe it's a way. Maybe they're actually building that into the tracks to fucking annoy DJs or something.
Or they're trying to go for the loudness war or something.
Yeah,
because it's like they actually. It was like the last one. Like I say, I was running it at about twice the volume we're talking, which is really quiet for music, but it actually made my. And this was a big, like, it wasn't a track I got off a blog. It was a, a big studio track, and it just loaded. Oh, it was the Pitch Black album that Mike gave me, and a couple of them just made my speakers go until I pulled it back.
Mm.
Who knows? Anyway. So this is the latest I've done one of these, and I'm fucking really tired, but...
Sorry, man.
No, this is great that you've come. Sorry, I don't mean it like that. I just mean, like, it's been interesting. I've done them at, like, 9 a.m. I've done them all through the day.
I've had
fuck, it's amazing I'm up to 18.
Yeah, man, I feel bad for taking that long. Shit.
No,
it's
good.
I think be, like, the second one.
Might be strategically good, waiting until there's actually...
Yeah, true. Cool.
Okay, so that's a longer... because obviously I know you, rather than just sitting here going, okay, we'll start. I have no plan.
Cool.
No plan.
We could go a little bit meta and talk about the conception and where you are so far as well.
Okay, we could. Yeah. And your timber's sounding great, and so is mine.
Timber.
Yeah, so what I normally do, you would have heard it in the intros, is two or three pages of Googling. I have one little pad with just some key points. So I'll just have to make up the intro. So here we go. My guest is painter. What do I say, artist?
Artist, because I don't like to limit myself to one genre, man.
My next guest is an artist, which encompasses, I guess, painting, visual arts, DJing, web design, There's an art to that.
Yeah, we can go into the detail on that and why I don't do so much of it anymore, because there's less art to it now.
Yes, and I noticed there's more art in terms of the art that you want to pursue in your life.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that okay?
That's beautiful.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, Lewis. My guest is Paul Walsh, and I first met Paul when I was 15 or 16. That must have been around that age. I felt so much older. At a theatre sports camp, I think, in your hometown or nearabouts.
Out by the Blue Lake.
What was your theatre sports team called?
Oh, God knows. I can't even, I was the only one from my school that was in the team, so I was kind of just thrown in with the Lakes High. Lakes High was the school that had an actual drama department, and ours was just a shoddy, thrown together public school exclusive one. I was literally the only one in my year doing drama or the arts in general out of 120 boys.
What was everyone else doing? Rugby?
Yeah. And cricket.
Right. Has it changed now? Because I noticed schools.
No.
Oh, really? Because I noticed like...
No, it's an all boys side. It's still... I think we may have won last year's secondary school.
I still say we.
I'm still proud of that shit.
Yeah, so you enjoyed it. So you're a bit of a fish out of water, but you...
Yeah. Well, I was lucky that I went to a boys school and down the road was the girls school, like 800 metres or so. And because I was the only one doing art history... I got to go to the girls' school 4 days a week and do a class down there because they had art history down there. So I was the bearer of notes and contacts and party invitations. This is back in, obviously, pre-social media days. And so I got, it worked out quite well for me.
Okay. Yeah. So you were hinting it was kind of you going down the player route, but you actually said you were the messenger boy for...
Yeah, pretty much. So I got popular at both ends of the process through that intermediary setting.
Yes. So I don't remember much of the theatre sports. I remember us... I have a vivid memory of us obsessing over... I think I must have brought my ghetto blaster.
You did. You bought your ghetto blaster
and
you had the same pack of stickers from Hot Metal magazine that I did. And I think it was in particular Pantera had released Vulgar Display of Power shortly before that. Yeah. And we bonded over the Dimebag Darrell riffage on that album. You know, it was one of those great albums that has like all those... And there's like silence in between these monstrous riffs.
I could imagine if you said to someone like Phil Anselmo that they were funky, he'd punch you in the head because he's a racist asshole. But they're funky.
Oh, there's a lot of
a lot of that 90s.
Yeah. It's what became known as It's what turned into new metal, which is a horrible term and brings to mind Limp Bizkit and all that. But stuff like the Sepultura album Roots, and that Pantera stuff, and the bottom end was badass. The Suicidal Tendencies that I loved, you know, they put out that Violent and Funky, the Infectious Grooves side album.
Yeah.
Bobby Trujillo on the bass, like, damn! And that's... anyone who's seen Some Kind of Monster will know Bobby has got the slap.
You know that he has funded, in the last couple of years, Jaco Pastorius doco?
I believe
so. He put a whole lot of Rob money, Metallica money, into that film. It's supposed to be amazing. I've actually just reminded myself to chase it on up. That reminds me, speaking of watching stuff, because I've been really slack lately, have you watched the new Chappelle?
No.
Stand up? Okay.
Don't watch much stuff, but I do. I've heard.
I'll be the same. Are you getting too busy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Two kids, lots of projects around.
Yeah. I mean, when I was doing web design, I'd always have like a TV show or something been able to run in the background, but I'm trying to limit my computer time in general. Like,
really?
I've been really trying to cut down on the time that I spend in front of a screen. And it's been difficult.
That sounds very un-Paul. Why is that?
It was bad for me physically and mentally and financially as well, because I can't focus as well as I thought I might be able to. Turns out if you spend like 15 years as a slacker employee and then you suddenly try and become your own boss.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Do you mean
online distraction, like you kind of became the king of New Zealand Reddit and so on? Do you mean that sort of stuff? Or?
Yeah, that shit comes into play. just having all that knowledge, Wikipedia holes is the bad one for me. Like, I'll literally sit there hitting random article on Wikipedia, reading about some frickin' hill in Canada, or the great copper famine of 1817 and how it affected railroad development. I don't know. Don't Google that one. That's
Yeah.
I have this thirst for knowledge, and the internet, it's like, if you have a thirst for knowledge, the internet's like a hose to your face. That's just too much. And I need to cut myself off from it and just be like, okay, if I'm on a computer, I've got to be doing work. I've got to be sending out invoices and replying to emails.
I got no... Look, I feel like we're cut from similar cloth, and you saying all that, I have no idea how I finished a thesis when there was the internet in the background. You're so right. Because, I can't speak for you, but I think you've said your things, Reddit and mine's Facebook. But funnily enough, like you say, man, like I've just realized as you said all that, that my kind of obsession to post and so on has actually kind of waned lately. Or the other thing I'd do is I'd sit there and often...
You've been busier, that's the thing.
Well, it's not just that. No. What I was going to suggest, bro, is maybe because like we're monkeys at the end of the day, and it's like, so there was the tool back then, and now the latest tool, the latest kind of big innovation we've had humanity-wise is obviously this whole online buzz, particularly since 2007, 2008. Mm. Maybe you and I just got in there and just were fizzing at the bung, and now it's just reached its kind of natural... You know what I mean? What's next here?
See, I'm
not going to sit in front of this the next 20 years.
I had this weird sort of introduction. I've actually been posting on message boards quite hard out since 2000. There was one called OK Player, which was based around The Roots and their Philadelphia conscious rap crews, Blackalicious, Erykah Badu, Common. And they had a really active message board, discussion board on there. And I was like, holy shit, these are people that I don't know, but they're talking about really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And I still have like a whole bunch of online friends that I still like. I'm friends with Facebook on them and stuff. And they're producing like some of the most interesting content, and they've gone on to do like amazing shit. And just, it really made... I've heard it described that... forums like Reddit and sort of where you coalesce around a shared idea and a passion, they make you love people that you don't know, and then Facebook makes you hate the people you do know.
Oh,
because it sort of it depresses me. yeah, the same response here. Like, I don't know. There's so much good that's come out of social media, and it's given me like a lot of opportunities in my life. Like, just getting fans in general is the most amazing shit ever. Like, getting people to actually chow down my art as part of their daily social media feed is great, but at the same time I need to disengage from it. Like, I don't share much of my life. I don't really personally put much out there. Like, the amount of status updates that I've written and then deleted, and like, I need to make sure that I don't actually get too involved in it.
And then also, you also know what the girl that you talked to twice in Standard 4 who added you is doing with her life in the minutia. So that's awesome.
Woo!
And then you remove her, and then she angrily adds you again. A specific story, Paul. This isn't a specific story.
No. It's the anti-vax things that makes me hate people that I would otherwise have no problem with. Just that sort of, like, really, like, people that have, like, these points of view that they believe so passionately, but they're demonstrably wrong. And you put it out there in the world. They're trying to tell people that this is... And I just can't... I can't take that.
What you're saying is people who essentially, when it's boiled down, say, actually, no, your facts are wrong, my facts are right. Well, it's actually... Well, hang on, there's only one set of facts, because they're facts. And you've confused... Opinion, you've confused opinion with facts.
Yes. I'll say that...
And that's dangerous.
This much exposure to the internet and forums has turned me from being an atheist to being an agnostic, which is another way of saying, I don't give a fuck anymore. I'm stepping back from all of that shit. And that applies to a lot of other...
Remind me of those definitions. An atheist...
Okay,
one of them believes there may be some kind of sentient... some kind of higher power... But it ain't a Jesus buzz. The other one's just like, it's all nothing.
An atheist says there is no God.
Yeah.
That's a stupid idea.
Mm.
Shut up, you're wrong.
Yeah.
An agnostic says there's no way to answer that question, so why bother even fucking asking the question?
And you're in the latter camp now.
Yeah, I'm stepping back.
So how's social media changed that?
Forums in particular, like just seeing how people act on Reddit in particular. Like it used to be that the atheism Reddit was one of the main ones you subscribe to, and then just seeing the sort of arguments brought up on there, it's like, why do you have to be such a dick to people you don't know? And Bill Maher, his movie
Religious.
Yeah. What a prick.
You didn't like it?
I did not like
why,
it.
Why? 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 Why?
I mean, it's. You don't have to be an asshole about it, you know?
Oh, you mean sort of rubbing it in other people's faces?
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, that's really great you brought that up, because something that was lost a minute or two ago that I was going to point out is something I felt bad about on social media in terms of that recently, everything we've been talking about, is when I cut and pasted that old teenage friend, lovely guy. I know exactly who the guy is, but you remember because you were the first person who commented. You may remember. We
do lots of commenting. Something about the...
And I cut and pasted about his basically, essentially, I got to say it, like idiotic interpretation of what was going on with Trump in the States. And the reason I broke was because he had got to a point in my feed over a few days where I felt like, I don't know why I felt like I had to shut him down.
Mm.
But it was just frustration. But anyway, after I cut and pasted it and posted it on my page and everyone started piling on, I actually felt really bad about doing that, you know, a day or two later. Do you know what I mean? So there's all of that.
Yeah.
So it sort of came from a good place, but then I realized the way I'd written it all and stuff, I was being all like highfalutin and there's so much to it, eh? It's just like we're all just... The whole world's just piling onto each other at the moment.
I don't believe the.
But you know what I mean, right? With that post,
yeah.
I wiped it. I was like, this is dirty. I've been dirty. I did. You know, and that's not where I started with it.
Yeah,
you know?
I try not to post about. I try not to post about the things that I really believe. Like I have fairly far left political beliefs. I'm essentially a lazy Marxist, for want of a better term. But I don't post about that stuff because it'll lead to arguments with people that I don't really have a problem with.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to, when you're online having these discussions, it's so easy to basically create the enemy out of the other person, out of the other side of the argument, and it shouldn't be that way. And I still believe that if you're having these conversations with those exact people face-to-face, you wouldn't end up in that position. Because people are more empathetic when we have faces there, when it's just words on a screen.
Well the other thing you're right, because you know, it was actually quite poignant when I listened to Obama do a long-form podcast. He kind of said, in terms of the states, like, you know, he said, well, wherever I visit around the US, you know, the Democrat or Republican, you know, people kind of have the same, you know, hopes and dreams and concerns and so on and so forth. So to that point, like you're right. Before all of this, we couldn't sort of pry into the minutiae of people's psyche, and I think you're right, it does get weird with what you're saying, like people I would have got on with otherwise, because case in point, I've met, you know, that he is called a right-wing commentator. Have you heard of Matthew Hooton? So he's a quote-unquote right-wing commentator for hire, Radio Live, think pieces in the Herald, yada 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 yada, it goes on. Met him, quote unquote, in real life, and I hate that phrase because it's all real life, but lovely guy, charismatic, super smart. We hit it off like a house on fire. Not an evil man. You know, I hate all that as well. You know, this side's evil and this one's not.
Yeah.
A guy I'd happily hang out with more. We have different political beliefs. Sure, that makes the world go around, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a funny thing. It is a funny thing.
I can actually... segue this back into my art, because do you remember the painting I did last year called Cultivation Theory? It's a painting of Deva Mahal, and it was on the side of a building, and it's basically in that Carmen Burana with all the fruit piled up on her head, but it was all like jet fighters, televisions, phones, guns.
The reason I remember it is because I linked you to the most heartily meaty academic paper I teach in our degree, which is MediaCom 2, and said, Paul, cultivation theory is a media theory. Have you heard of it? And I linked you some academic papers.
Yeah.
Had you heard of it before?
Yes.
Oh, you had? Okay.
Yes, that's why I did it. I mean, that's... and that's...
George Gerbner.
I say the deepest I got into it was reading, like, 5 Wikipedia articles. Yeah. I didn't actually go and fossick around in a pile of index cards in an old library.
Well, Gerbner's basic...
I got quite deep into
Gerbner, I'll let you go on with it, but Gerbner's basic buzz was that... he looked into the effect of violence on television viewers, but typically that topic, as when it's reported in the media every now and again in terms of studies and stuff, is done in terms of, do computer games make little Johnny more violent? His buzz was, does exposure to TV violence cultivate a perception in people that the world they live in is more scary than it is?
Mm.
And he called it the mean world syndrome. Mm. So that's cultivation theory in an essence.
And of course, it was written before computer games were really...
Totally. Yeah.
But I think that if you extend it to social media as well, it's gotten even worse, because we're getting media bubbles that are available all the time in our pocket. It's not just when you're at home watching the news.
Mm.
And I believe that mean world syndrome has been exacerbated tenfold by the rise of this this bubble we created.
What, you think people think the world's scarier, or what are you meaning more?
Yeah, way scarier. If you look at the crime rate, crime rates have been going down since 1992 when they finally killed that Tupac.
But how does social media play into that?
Because you're fed articles and points of view that reinforce your base fears. Like if you're right,
you got to change your friend list, bro.
No, yeah. You know, it's like that. If I sign up to, you know, left wing points of view, if I have like Huffington Post, Washington Post, and you know, the Guardian, then you start seeing like how Trump and his team are screwing the world and things you should be scared of from that side. If you're signed up to Fox News and Breitbart, and then you're seeing how immigrants are stealing your babies from your bedroom when you're not looking, and it's sort of like whatever side you're on, you're getting these points of view that reinforce that and make you more afraid and less trustful of people and more of a dick.
Yeah, but hang on from that. You just said something that concerns me in that. So have we only got left-wing and right-wing newspapers? I thought journalism was impartial.
No. I wish. That'd be nice. I think
so. Oh God,
we're all biased somewhere along a spectrum.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So there's no true partisan... I always get this wrong way around. I've said this before on the podcast. Impartisan or partisan?
Partisan is party oriented. So you're one end.
Well,
let's go
left or right wing oriented. Yeah. So we have no non-partisan media the way you see it.
I think if you look at like AP and Reuters, like the actual, like the really
the feed of what's going on.
The feed, you know, like they're just like, this is what happened.
Yeah.
They don't say this is what happened. Isn't that bad? They don't say, look out, this is going to happen. It's going to be, you know, they don't
this is what happened,
in the
guy's
futurology
an asshole.
Or whatever. Yeah. They try and stay as unbiased as they can. But, we don't get most of our news from The Wire. So it's up to, you know, people get served it in bite-sized pieces through the filter of, you know, either selective news agencies or their friends ranting about it.
Yeah.
And so we do, we all always have a bubble.
So how much, I mean, I'm sure you're not like, you haven't got a little graph on the fridge. If you do, good, you know, all power, but as a percentage, how much less screen time do you think you're having since you took on this crusade?
If I try and stay off it if I can, but as Kate can attest, I do spend hours lecturing idiots in the evening sometimes, but I try and stay off it. Yeah, but I try and get actually work. That's the thing. I need to wean myself off it. You heard of like those plugins, like Stay Focused, things you can put in your browser, limit you to like an hour a day on these. I used those for years, and they work quite well.
Some Champix add-on on your.
Yeah. You're like, get off. Like I have to be brutal with myself. Like I don't trust myself. But I know, as far as like during the day goes, that's cut right the hell back. Like I'd have, like 2-3 hours a week and during business hours when I'll be at a computer. And
so you still got the studio on K Road, but it's becoming more a base for all these. You seem to be increasingly on the road, doing spec art projects and on walls and vans and and so on. It's been great. What, you know, how long you've been back in New Zealand? About the same amount of time as I have. 10 years.
Yeah, about a decade. Yeah.
And like I said to you before we went on the record, you know, with this podcast thing, I'm sort of going to organically see where it goes. And I'm not saying that you haven't had a kind of plan with this, but at the same time, you kind of nicely let it organically grow the way
I've had a plan.
Oh, I'm sure you've
had a plan since I was like 14, I think.
Okay.
Well, can I be a full-time artist when I was 14? And then it's basically been a series of shitty jobs on the way to trying to make that happen.
Okay, well, that's...
Yeah.
I think your take on it's better than mine. I didn't mean you just being random and haphazard by any means, if that's what you're talking about.
Oh, no, there was a bit of... I mean, there's a bit of experimenting to see exactly how you're going to be an artist.
So do you reckon you're nearly full-time now?
Yeah, yeah.
How long lasts?
I've had probably 2 years of mural painting and art being my full-time occupation.
I didn't realise you weren't doing much web design anymore stuff, man. No, that's awesome.
No, your site was like the only one I've done for about the last year.
And isn't it spectacular?
Yes.
I'll have to edit out those claps later.
I got onto web design through doing Flash. Do you remember Flash back in the day?
Yeah, every Wellington music website used it.
Yeah,
yeah.
A lot of websites did. Yeah. And what I liked about it was that you could do little animations, you could record your own sound effects.
Yeah.
I made a website for this awesome artist called Dave Beasley, and I spent like a whole day trying to record the sound of meat splattering onto the ground, because you press a button and this little character would jump off a roof.
Yeah,
and then I had to get the perfect sound of him splatting onto the ground below, and then like all of these little crazy animations that I do, and I love that stuff, and that's what got me into web design. But then after I did like 50 sites or so, mobile phones came along, and we're basically mobile phones were like, hey, we like all that fancy design you got going there, it's all got to go.
Yeah,
and then it's all about the content and making it resize and all being responsive, and it just got a boring freaking slog of changing this line on that page for a couple of years.
So you're feeling like the creativity's gone out of it.
Absolutely.
Let's move on from that. How did it take from, what's the process going from 15 to late 30s in terms of that journey of becoming a full-time artist? Why does it take that long? I mean, you know, a bookbinding apprenticeship used to be 9 years, so you're not far off, you know?
Well, it was sort of, I thought that I could just do canvases and just paint canvases and somehow get noticed, while at the same time not engaging with the dealer, gallery, collector scene or art school at all. Like I my whole career seems to be a fight of not being told what to do.
Yeah.
And so I didn't go to art school. I don't like I don't like jobs in general. I don't like having to be somewhere at a certain time.
Yeah.
I don't like I don't like receiving phone calls. Yeah. As you know, sorry about that. But
that's right.
Whenever my phone rings, my first instinct is like, ah, fuck off.
Yeah.
Who's that?
Yeah.
Taking my time away. What are you doing?
I think I phoned you once about 3 years ago, and I got off, and I was like, ugh, what just happened there?
Yeah, no.
Oh, man.
If you're a future client and you're still with us, if you want to be on my good side, email. Please email me about work.
What is this magic ringing talking box?
Yeah, I mean, half the time I'll be up a ladder with like holding a spray can, and I'll be like paint all over my hands. I've got to fish the phone out of my pocket without dropping it, which has happened a lot, as you can see. This bloody thing's shattered. I wanted to be my own boss. I wanted to sell canvases. I wanted to live off my art. But I had many years of painting canvases, selling them for a pittance, selling them for way below what I should have been.
Yeah.
Lugging them around town and hanging them in every cafe and bar that I could find that would hang them. I probably painted...
You mean from 15 to now? Or just
from 15 to now. I sold my first painting when I was 15. And I've probably done about... I've probably sold about 400 canvases since then.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until when I moved to Auckland and I started using spray cans more, because I actually had a job where I had enough money to afford decent spray cans.
Yeah.
Up until then, all the spray cans I could afford were just the crappiest Dulux sort of brand without the proper nozzles and all my... Like, I tried doing political graffiti and stencils for years and...
But back in the day, in like those Star Wars days and stuff, it would have been the equivalent of Dulux cans, right?
Oh, no, you still had good caps and good cans.
But they weren't being made. Well. They weren't being made specifically for graffiti art. You mean
In the 80s. I mean, there's a reason most 80s graffiti looks like the way it does, because they didn't have the technology to create straight lines a lot of
the time. So what I'm getting at, this is the boffin in me needs to know this. So there's a cap that's been designed specifically for graffiti art.
Yeah, over time there have been caps developed you know, you have like fat and thin caps, and you have caps to create different thickness of lines. And just paint that applies better for artists. It's all sort of improved over the years.
Yeah.
I spent my 20s wanting to be a DJ and wanting to be a full-time DJ as well.
Yeah.
So I sort of didn't really have much time for running around and practicing art on the weekends. Like, my friends went into graffiti. My friends were all DJs and MCs. And that was a big part of like been into graffiti from a young age, is you've got to be with the crew, and you all go out bombing together.
Yeah.
And I didn't have that, so I was off doing like weird punk slogans and stencils around Wellington, and then, you know, running up and down the canals in London by myself. But it was always a solo mission for me. It was only when I moved to Auckland that I actually met anyone else who did graffiti.
Yeah, oh really? Yeah.
And
Back to the you sold a bunch of canvases because you're moving on to talking about how you like you. I think you're basically sort of what I think you were getting to was that you realized maybe that your approach wasn't the best for where you wanted to.
Yeah, I just wasn't reaching enough people.
Yeah,
it's the art world is such a weird sort of world to be involved in. It's so much about perception of. You know, how do you price a piece of art?
Yeah.
That whole thing. It's a weird universe. And the art school sort of process to get in there, it's quite delineated. If you look at, like, who's considered the greatest artist, they all go through art school and then are involved with those institutions later.
You mean throughout history or
in the last 100 years? The last 100 years, particularly in contemporary New Zealand.
Yeah.
And it's only...
So he went to Elam,
Whereas the scene that I identify with the most grew up in opposition to that, and one name for it is lowbrow. Came out of California in the 60s and 70s as kind of like, along with like skate and surf culture, it was sort of like the artworks that adorn the t-shirts of that era, which then became part
of... You mean,
of,
what, part, hang on, where are we going? Mumbo? Like that kind of
No.
What's lowbrow?
Lowbrow is, you know, the hot rod image of the big fat wheels and
like the bubblegum cards.
They were bubblegum cards by the time we were of age to recognize them. Robert Williams is the famous and the Rat Fink sort of character. And then that became like the Santa Cruz artwork, the Screaming Hand. That sort of stuff. And then just all the art you see around punk rock, all of the sort of zines and the sort of cut up.
So it's kind of a surf skate.
Surf skate punk sort of
West Coast, sunny
slight
punk vibe,
hot rod custom culture, that sort of thing, and the lowbrow scene came out of that, and that influenced graffiti a lot, because graffiti, of course, was born on the East Coast more than anything, but then they influenced each other, and it becomes part of the global artistic psyche over the 80s. And it's essentially...
Is the light bothering you?
No. I'm just staring into the distance.
Yeah, I was like, should I have to change these bulbs? Okay, all right, the direction.
Yeah, so lowbrow and pop surrealism is another name for it.
Yeah.
And I've definitely... surrealism has always been a huge love, thanks to my hippie parents that hung Dali and Escher all over the house when I was growing up. You know, that there's a Dali painting called Sleep. Fucking terrifying image of a giant green head up on stilts. I had a print.
Was it above your bed?
This big, above my bed, most of my life. And every time I went to the toilet, there's like one of those MCS strips going the length of our bathroom door.
So now whenever your mum goes, why don't you do this, Paul? You go, well, hang on a second. Let's talk about this painting that you hung above my bed.
I've always had the surrealism from that. I was like Obelix with the surrealism. And then the pop side of it. I mean, pop art. You know, Warhol. Obviously, pop art is about taking the idioms, the visual identity of branding of advertising and the processing, the sort of industrial style processes and materials, and then creating art with those. And so the pop surrealism is like, I don't know. It's probably the best term for what I do because it's. I'm not trying to disappear up my own arsehole. I'm doing things that people recognize, and I'm not afraid of selling out because I'll work for clients and I'll be like, yo, you want a tour?
But you've kind of, I mean, your understanding of the history of art and art movements would be better than mine. But to me, you kind of brought up one part of what I understand of pop art and then another, because you talked about the industrial, obviously the Campbell's soup can, hello.
Pop art is like 50s and 60s.
Totally.
And
pop surrealism came after that. I know the movement well, but then the bit I was about to ask you about was the more, the pop artist approach, which kind of Otis Frizzell touched on with me in the podcast, which is when people say to him, oh, you fucking sold out. He's like, no, I am an artist and I unashamedly, you know, this is my craft and my day job. And so I make art. I turn it over. I make it for the people. It's intentionally not highbrow, even though I could present it that way. So that's where I see your you know, attachment to pop art, maybe.
Yeah, well, I didn't really mean to bring up pop art as such, because I don't really identify with that. It's pop surrealism is the specific niche that I fall into. But it is, it's great that you brought up Otis, because of course his dad, Dick Frizzell, is one of our country's most successful commercial artists, if you want to put that term on it.
Yeah,
commercial artist, as in he spent his formative, most of his artistic years working for clients and creating artworks to spec. And that's basically what I do now with like schools and kindergartens. And it's a great way to fund the weirder art and still keep leveling up your skills.
But also, as you're obviously, you know, as is obvious to everyone who sees those works, and even just through social media and whatever, you're doing them because they're in, you know, really lovely places to do them. So there's, you know, before I say this, I don't want to slander doing something for, let's say, a wall at Colenso or whatever. I've no problem with where art goes or whatever, but you're doing them with a community mind to it as well. Mm. You're creating colourful spaces for communities where there weren't colourful spaces before, you know. It's a part of, you know, it's a job as well, but, you know, that, isn't that why you're choosing school walls and so on?
Oh, I love, I love, I absolutely love doing schools and kindergartens. It's, these kids will remember those artworks for the rest of their lives. And that's like injecting art into these, the lives of
it's like you've got a big, you know, how big are they generally, like 10 meters by some of them?
Yeah,
are huge,
like
right?
2 meters by 12 meters.
So you've got a 2 meter by 12 meter, essentially one page of a picture book, and we all remember the picture books we grew up with.
Yes. And so I can like, I bring in like, you know, the Red Admiral butterfly. I've been painting a lot of Red Admirals and kindies lately because people don't know enough about them because they're a beautiful butterfly. And awesome.
I don't know much about them.
Hoxtesser's frog. I did one of those a couple of weeks ago.
Is that a local frog?
Yeah, it's a really, it's a very ancient frog, one of the oldest frogs we know of, and it's you find it around the Waikato area.
Is it in abundance, or is it screwed like everything else?
Frogs generally don't live too well with pollution around because they sort of absorb it through everything.
Man, even the frogs.
Yeah. They're like the canary in the mine of nature, apparently. It's like when your frogs go, it's like there's something wrong there.
Wait, hang on a sec. Aren't the canaries canaries in the mind of nature?
Mines aren't really natural.
Yeah, okay. You
know? I mean, I know, a canary is a natural thing too. I know what you mean. But yeah, like when the frogs are dying off, then it's like the first sign of
I get it. Yeah, that's a very clear description.
So
the frogs are the canary in the mines of nature. Because
frogs are canaries.
Because frogs are in nature, and canaries in mines are not in nature. And to put a frog in a mine, frankly, would just be
fucking
another level of human,
straight away,
human destruction. So you move from canvases to walls, and you're about to explain how that went from you saying you're lugging around this stuff, selling it under market, da 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 da.
Yeah. Oh, there's a nice one. I actually used to literally sit in the street selling canvases quite often in Wellington before I left, and then in London when I first moved there. I had like, there were like 8 months where I was in London where I couldn't find a job. Yeah. I had to like, I shoplifted food and like just had a rough bloody time of it. And batteries for my Discman. Oh my God, that was a struggle.
I was going to say before, you should have stolen the good spray cans.
They had them under lock and key. Okay, by the time I got into them, they were behind the counter in a glass case. But no, I used to actually sit on Westminster Bridge and sell canvases of like the touristy things done in my sort of cartoony style.
Would you sell them?
Yeah. 10, 20 pounds each, depending on what they were.
That's amazing. I was on £3 an hour when I was there. That's very good.
Yeah, and so I'd have a blanket, a sheet laid out, and I'd have like 10 canvases propped up on the edge of Westminster Bridge. And then there'd be like me, there'd be the fella selling the dodgy hot dogs, someone selling the postcards, and some other guy lugging around a bloody printer and a car battery, and he'd take a photo of you and then print out a photo of you in front of the London Eye. It was like before everyone had a phone in their pocket. It was like crazy shit we did back in 2003 or so.
So it wasn't even a digital camera. It was kind of a really early digital camera.
Yeah. And he had like an actual like laser jet printer on like an airport trolley bag.
I was thinking like Dot Matrix, like.
Yeah.
Come back in 15 minutes.
All of us street hustlers would be like lined up. And then if the cops started walking down one end, they'd be like, poop, like the cooler go out. And everyone would have a way of just, like I had to just fold up my sheet, pick it up and hang it over my shoulder and just walk along casually.
So you had to turn it into like a hobo
rucksack. Like a bindle. Like immediate bindle. And so, yeah, and something that really made me upset today is seeing photos of the Westminster Bridge incident that happened yesterday, yeah. And one of the women, I think, was one of the postcard sellers.
Oh, that you remember?
Straight hustlers. No, not that I remember. No, not that bloody sad. But no, it was just like, man, that's... I mean, that's the reason I left that city, because I was there in for the 7th of July bombings, and the bus that exploded was one of the buses that I sometimes took into town from up in Hackney.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'm going back to Ngongataha. Let me get my ticket.
And I think just if we're going to go into that tour territory, I think with those incidents, we need to stop talking about terrorism and start addressing mental health, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So you fold up your... bindle? Did you call it a bindle?
Yeah, I guess. That's the official name for a tramp's, you know, belongings in a sack on a stick.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I hustled selling paintings and canvases wherever I could. Came back here, was a teacher for like 6 months, and that was awful. And then I moved to Auckland and got a job.
I thought you said it was okay.
Oh, it was really nice hanging out with the kids, but I was just a really bad teacher.
Yeah. Probably should have probably should have got some training, eh?
Yeah, probably should have had a bit of training there.
Okay.
All the kids still remember that. It's like, yeah, that was a fun time. But yeah, then I moved to Auckland and got a job with the Depot Art Space, building their websites. And I actually went in there to get on the PACE, the Pathway to Arts and Cultural Employment Scheme.
Yeah.
One of Helen Clark's awesome little schemes for getting artists some money.
Yeah.
And then they saw my website. And I was like, yeah, I built this myself. And they're like, oh, that's really good. Can you build our websites? And so I was on PACE for like 2 weeks, and then I got a job there.
Yeah.
And that was great. I still do a bit of work for them. I was there for about 2 years. That was my last real proper job, I guess.
Yeah.
Finished that in 2009 or 2010.
Yep.
And I've been freelance since then.
But mainly started off as visual art rather than web stuff.
Well, no, I started off as doing web stuff from home for like 3 or 4 years.
But since 2010, it's just been...
Dude, it's 2017.
That's what I'm saying. So 7 years, that's amazing. Well done.
I've had 7 years of no weekly wage. It's being a freelancer, it's like, I've described it as like every morning you're stepping off a cliff.
Yeah.
And just looking for somewhere to land, and then it's like every morning is a bloody nightmare.
So talk about Grumpy Cat on the reserve, on the dog.
Yeah,
and the
this
dog
is
part.
Weird. The two paintings...
Talk about the council meeting.
The two paintings that have given me the most press... are both ones that I did at night in the dark, up in our local dog park. And I was like, guys, I can do really good stuff in the day, you know.
Yeah.
But no, the Grumpy Cat was the first one. That was 2013 or so.
Yeah. I take it he was grumpy at the dogs in the park.
Yeah. It was before it was a cliched freaking meme. Yeah. You know, I got a cease and desist for trying to sell prints of that.
Yeah.
I was so careful of their Grumpy Cat copyright.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just because we live next to a dog park and there's a big water tank in there, and I thought it'd be funny to paint that cat up in there staring down at all the dogs looking super grumpy. And the community loved it to the point that the local board actually ran a petition. Yeah, that cat's name. The local board actually ran a petition to get Watercare to leave it. And so Watercare didn't paint over it, but then at some point someone else went and painted a giant love heart above it and it dripped all over them and they all had to be painted out. And now we've revisited that saga because...
Wait, but no, but in the interim, didn't you go and sit at the back of some, like, small-town-esque council meeting
and not tell them
who you were?
Yeah.
And so was there Watercare representatives and whoever the hell sits on small...
No, no, it was
councils.
All the local board members, and they were lovely, and I still... You know, they went into bat for me on this last one. And so, yeah, I went in, but I went in without them knowing who I was.
But did you go John Wayne Batman? Like, did you reveal that?
Yeah, at the end of the night, I was like, I'm Paul Walsh.
And what did they say?
Oh, hi, you should have said hi earlier, you weirdo. But no, we got to...
So the episode of that was the love heart got painted over.
Yeah, it all got painted over. I submitted a design to... What I wanted to do was go up there and take photos of all the dogs that go up to this dog park on a regular basis and paint a mural that wrapped around the whole thing with all their heads on it.
Oh, please.
And work in, like, Grumpy Cat and Dog from Foot Rock Flats and other animals.
Yeah.
Snoopy. But Watercare didn't want to sponsor that. It's all a bit tricky. And, yeah, so that sort of fell by the wayside. And so, yeah, and then part two happened last week, or 2 weeks ago or so, when Murray Ball passed, and I went up there and painted a portrait of Dog. And that got a crazy response, and to the point that, again, the local board petitioned Watercare to let it stay. Watercare liked it so much. Today I got a message that they have gone up and applied graffiti guard coating over it and put little plaques next to it saying, if there is tagging on this artwork, please call this number, we'll come and clean it off.
Wow.
Yeah. So this random...
Have they sent you some chocolates or something? Or?
No. But I mean,
that's lovely.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a particularly brilliant piece of artwork, but it's paying respect to a brilliant cartoonist.
So back to you saying the art world is this, that, and the other thing, and how do we value art and so on. It is a brilliant piece of art because you timed it well. It's from a lovely place. It's in the perfect spot for it. You know, it's a great piece of art.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
You know?
Yeah.
What are we going to go out and do like a fractal ballpoint pen 17-week?
I don't know. It only took me 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's overspray under the muzzle. But yeah, no, it was timing and placement, I guess. The art world is a weird one.
I sort of get it. Like, I've gone to openings and stuff, and hell, you know, I feel often, and not the one I went to of yours last, but yeah, sometimes I go, what is this world? Is this bullshit land? What is going on here? Am I stupid or am I smart? Is that $10,000 or is it $4?
I feel.
What is this person? What are you doing? Help me, Jesus Christ!
I feel the same, and that's what I don't like. There's kind of this predilection amongst the fine art teaching community, at least, to focus on the theory over the practicalities. Yeah. Like, if you want to focus on the practicalities, you go to freaking Polytech. And they have art classes there.
Yeah.
But if you want to actually, if you're going to study art as a career at the higher academic levels, it becomes almost entirely about theory and not art history. Like, that's seen as a separate subject.
Yeah.
And that pisses me off, because if you focus too much on the theory, then it drives a wedge between the general public and the art, and it makes people feel like you need to know about the finer details of abstract expressionism in order to appreciate the most basic artworks. And it shouldn't be that way. It should be an instinctual. You should be able to look at something and go, I like that, I don't like that.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways it's great to know the details and what the symbolism of certain shapes might be, or what the artist's intention was by doing a certain thing, but it shouldn't need that.
But then, do you think to be a good DJ, which is your other passion, you don't need to know the history?
I don't know.
So you just jump on and find some tunes online. It
depends what you're trying to do. Again, if you're trying to be a selector,
I hear you. Yeah, but it's like,
and present great music, then you need to know the history of that.
You need to know the history. It's a funny one, eh?
Yeah, I think with all art, it does help to know the history, just to prevent you going over the same ground over and over again.
Yeah. So you know, I was intentionally being contentious. Because when you said that, I thought, I agree. But then I had was that, you know, that like, you know the history, da 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 da.
Well, put it this way, you
hip-hop mantra and so on.
If you're a good DJ, the average person should be able to tell or not if they listen to you play for an hour.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you'd be up, because everyone can hear like a DJ doing a train wreck or playing something way louder or playing a song that really doesn't fit.
No, you're right. So and then to flip what I just said, like before I, because you do know the history of art and the music, but getting knowledge on anything, you know, my knowledge of music is a continuing evolving thing from however old I was. And then when I got into playing records, you know, learning about stuff just comes. It's just a part of it. But yeah, you're right. Like when I first got a 1200 and had like four records from Flipside and put them both on, and no one showed me anything, and I got them together perfectly, it was like, holy shit, I can intuitively do this.
Yeah.
And I know I can intuitively do it better, no disrespect, to a bunch of people I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then all the knowledge and how to, okay, well, this record's kind of okay, but actually it's a bit cheesy now. I've learned about this. Now, yeah, it's a funny thing. It's a real balance, right?
Mm.
Yeah. So that's my rant about DJing and art. visual art, at least.
You don't have to say that's my rant. You're doing a fucking podcast. The whole thing's a rant.
Yeah.
This is Rants with Lewis.
Yeah.
Subtitle.
Yeah, that's right. You know, on a day when the, serotonin is less than it should be, I go, why the hell am I doing this? Like, who the hell am I to expect that people are going to download and stream an hour and 20 minutes of someone talking that happens to be me? I'm going to hide under my bed.
Oh, no, every artist needs some self-doubt. You need to have self-doubt, and you need to be challenging yourself and pushing yourself, or else you'll never progress as an artist, you know? You can do the same safe things over and over again. What's that saying that's been variously attributed to 1,000 people? If you want to avoid criticism, say nothing, do nothing, be nothing.
Oh, goodness.
Yes, you're doing something.
I think we need to do these earlier in the day.
How's now for a halotel? That's their slogan.
And then we'll go ding.
Yeah.
Okay, that's terribly cheesy. So anyway, Paul, how's now for a halotel? So where are we going? That's often we break with it.
My long and varied art career.
Yeah, well, let's go right back, which is often where I really start. Like, you as a kid, how does this all start? Where are you from? Who are your family?
Product of a couple of hippies that came over from on a boat from the UK. They came over from Norwich, Lowestoft, that sort of area.
Mm-hmm.
They came over here in the 60s, started out in...
Why would some hippies leave the UK in the 60s?
Their parents left. My grandparents came over here. And once, I think when my grandfather found out he could move here and keep his pension from the post office, because he'd been a postie, but his hearing had deteriorated from World War II. He lost his hearing loading shells into a ship thing. And my other grandfather on my father's side, who I've only met once, was also involved in World War II. He was Polish, and their village was near Warsaw and got kind of flattened.
Polish Jew?
No.
Polish.
Polish. Yeah. But they spoke German because they were near the border, and when the Russians came in, they assumed the whole family were spies or something or whatever. But for some whatever reason, my grandfather, when he was 14... was sent to a Siberian gulag for like 5 or 6 years. And then he ended up moving to the UK, had my dad over there. My dad got adopted out, I think. And then I think my grandfather ended up in Florida, and now he's drinking himself to death in a garage in Australia somewhere.
Your father?
My grandfather.
Grandfather?
Yeah, yeah.
On your father's side?
My father, yeah.
So sort of similar genetics through the father's side.
Yeah, well, my father's... My old man's going to listen to this, so Chris, what up?
Will he?
He probably will, yeah.
Okay.
So I can't...
Okay, well, I won't say... I was going to cheers you again for the dysfunctional fathers.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, he's still left when I was 4, so I can't say anything. That's all we'll say.
Mine left when I was 3, that's okay.
We turned out fine.
Yeah.
But no, I had a great childhood. You know, an awesome stepfather came along and stepped in and did everything that he needed to do.
Yeah.
I've got a great sister. I've got 2 awesome younger brothers. Lived in sunny Rotorua.
Yeah.
Grew up in the southwest edge.
Yeah.
Then moved out to Nongataha just before I left. And Nongataha is a little village up on the northwest corner of the lake.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Wellington. Spent 6 years down in Wellington.
Mm.
Slowly getting my degree. I sort of fried my brain after the first year.
Did you finish?
Yeah, eventually. Took 4.5 years to do a 3-year degree. I had a break thanks to overindulging in the party scene down there, and I had to leave town and gather my brain. Spend a summer as a whitewater rafting, filming whitewater rafting, like sitting in the front of a raft as it goes down the river.
Yeah.
And then selling those videos.
And then with the interest du jour at the time for the 4.5 year BA, you only paid $384,000 for it.
Jesus Christ, man, the interest I paid, whoa. Yeah, it was ridiculous. I have not paid it off. I've barely made a dent in it.
Before you go on, I'll tell you a story. So my buddy Shay in Melbourne, different but similar story. A similar story for a lot of people when they're finding themselves you know, in that age. I think did part of a horticultural degree, did part of a BA, you know, essentially probably around your thing, let's just say 5 years for argument's sake in total. Neglected it for a while because he was overseas, as people do. Decided to do the honest buzz. It's up to 70-something thousand dollars now. He phoned up and he basically did what you do with a regular business. He said, look, I'll... because he'd come into some money. I said, look, I'll offer you... I haven't got the details exactly right amount-wise. I'll offer you 60K if we just settle this now. Mm. Who rings the student loan people and says, I will transfer $60,000 if we can knock off this $75,000 debt from 20 years ago?
Wow.
You know what happened?
They did it?
Nope.
Ooh.
They said, nah. Keep paying your meager installments, your meager installments, your meager installments, your meager installments.
Oosh.
Government bureaucracy, man.
Mm.
But what were you like as a kid?
Okay, at kindergarten, this is what my mum likes to tell. At kindergarten, when my mum came to get me one day, the teacher took her aside and said, but worried about Paul? He's used up all the black paint. And I'd painted a white sheet entirely black.
Yeah.
And my excuse was that I wanted to paint on black paper. I had no freaking black paper, so I had to make it myself. And then I've always, I don't know... I've always, as far back as I can remember, I've always wanted to be an artist.
Yeah.
And I got my start from doing skill set art, did some paintings, and then one of my mum's friends bought one from our house, was like, oh, buy that for $80. And I was like, get the fuck out of here. You'll pay money for that.
Yeah.
And so like a year or so later, I had my first exhibition when I was 15 in the Fat Dog Cafe.
Yeah.
Sold like 4 pieces and then kept doing that. Exhibitions in Bodega and other like 20 other spots around Wellington. Yeah. And, yeah, my degree was in composing soundtracks for plays and short films, which I did not use after I graduated.
That's very specific. When I did that, you and I were in the same theatre and film department. Was just film theory.
Yeah, no, I got well into the technical side of it. We won a Fringe Award the next summer, but that was it. But that translated into DJing, basically, because I was doing radio DJing on the side, and then... Once I graduated, I was like, well, I know how to like set a scene through sound and the basics of audio production and sound soundboyism. So I started doing shows with the Toasty Fellas, with the Home Base crew.
Yeah.
Played at the Gathering many times.
Yeah.
And kept DJing over in London. I got to like 27, 28, and I was like, well, I'm really enjoying DJing. It makes good money, but I don't feel like I'm going to get much further with it. I got to play at Fabric.
Yeah.
And that was like the highlight of my DJing career, although it was on a Thursday and kind of early, but I still got to play at Fabric and play my records over this like 30,000 watt sound system. It was like amazing.
I
was like, I don't think I can take this much further. I'm going to just try and do something more original. And that's when I started really getting into the art.
I'm with you there. Like, it's something that I've only... You know how you intuitively do stuff and maybe you process it over weeks or months or years or whatever, and then you realize down the track with hindsight, oh, that's kind of why I did that. So for me, you know, obviously like it's a 360-degree turn, but you know, big turn from playing at the most 4 or 5 nights a week when I was in Melbourne.
Mm.
You know, that's a lot of nighttime life.
Mm.
Coming back here, going, I'll do post-grad study for 4 or 5 years, da-da-da-da. But the point of that is, the punchline of that is, I realized that whole hip-hop thing, even though it wasn't hip-hop music itself, but the whole idea in my head I had with DJing and music was, got to keep it real, you got to keep it real, you got to keep it real. And then I got to like early 30s and I'm like, well, if keep it real means I'm going to fuck up the rest of my life... because I haven't got that far with it, I need to change my priority. Yeah. And I need to make it clear here, I'm not saying that about taking music as a career at all. I mean, for me, exactly what you said, I realized, unfortunately, I'd taken it to a point, and I was at a point in my life where I needed to do something else. Yeah. And I would have loved to have gone to that next level, but I hadn't, and I'm not going to keep it real till 65, and you know, does that speak to you?
Totally.
I mean, but you kind of feel like, I failed to keep it real.
Damn, I've gone fake. Everything's gone fake now.
Now I'm keeping it real safe.
I had a similar transition with art as with music. And I sort of, you know, like with DJing, yeah. Like I'm DJing at like 4 weddings in the next 5 weeks.
Nice. Funeral?
No, not yet. Mm. I don't know what I'd play at a funeral. Hey, you want to hear Clapton? Here's Eric Clapton.
Yeah. I hear choral music's quite...
Apparently in England, the Match of the Day theme song is quite... No, that's a wedding song, sorry. For some reason, the Match of the Day theme song is one of the top 10 wedding songs in the UK.
Yeah.
Apparently it's quite moving. But yeah, and I sort of... I would never... Like, if you asked me, like, 15 years ago, would you DJ a wedding? I'd be like, hope they like drum and bass.
Yeah.
And that would have been, you know, you want some Red Man, Method Man?
Yeah.
I got one or the other.
Yeah.
What? That? I'm not playing that. Get out of here. But, I mean, that was also because he had spent $20 on each tune. But now I'll just, like, I don't give a shit, man.
Are these weddings of people you know?
No, not all of them.
So how are you getting these wedding bookings, Paul?
Mostly through Halitale.
Wow.
Yeah.
And their weddings at...
various venues.
See, well, yeah, for me, like, I get that. So for me with that thing, it's not so much, you're right, back in the day it would have been like, I'm not playing that, but for me, the thing with weddings and those kind of pay for play gigs that aren't in the scene or whatever, well, like, let's say like-minded people, because scene sounds wanky, is I don't like the interpersonal warfare that occurs between people and me at those gigs.
Yeah.
I don't deal well with the brother who starts off well and then descends and then wants this. Like,
bro, just play some Beyonce.
I see people who do that as a living, who have a great skill with people. I don't have. I've got better with it.
Yeah.
But I find DJing so meditative. I don't like feeling like I'm under attack while I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So that's why I struggle with those gigs, but all power to you.
I usually, at the start of the night, if anyone starts talking to me, I'll usually say, hey, if you want any requests, here are 3 request tokens that you get to use throughout the night.
Yeah.
Once you've used up your tokens, that's it.
That's right. And now here's another piece of paper with the plot written on it. If you lose that, no more requests, okay?
But, yeah, I mean, I generally just say, yeah, I'll get to that, and then don't get to it. But I've gotten better at fielding those sort of things. I was really bad for a while. In London, a friend of mine made me a T-shirt that said, I'm not a fucking jukebox. Because that's what I screamed at some girl at his party when she was demanding to hear something. And I just turned around and said, I'm not a fucking jukebox. And the next time I went there, they're like, we've got a T-shirt for you, bro. I sort of softened on that stance.
It's like when the otherwise mild-mannered Dylan C. Piped up in a conversation and, about cell phones being thrust at DJs or smartphones, and said he just picked one up the other night and threw it across the fucking bar.
You want
someone who's keeping it real.
Yeah,
it's Dylan.
I've gotten less precious about DJing. Like, I'll play Bruno Mars and I'll be okay with it. I can still happily sleep that night.
Yeah,
because it makes them dance, makes them happy.
That's right.
And then I still get to play Method Man later on.
Yeah,
so everyone's happy.
So look in the, I don't know if it's stocked up, but look behind the computer, there's a black bag. You know you're a fan of the show.
Is it already time?
You know what that is.
Have we been talking that long?
No, I'm going to introduce it early.
Okay.
Yeah.
The awkward satchel of segues.
What?
Whose voice?
Is it Leon?
Which Leon? No, it's Thomas Watts from my first episode.
Oh, from the first episode,
He named it inadvertently.
Oh, yes.
The awkward satchel of segues.
What is your strongest sense? Foreboding, I'd say.
Oh. Lateral.
My hearing's pretty good.
So why foreboding?
No, that was just a silly joke.
Okay.
I'd actually say my hearing is pretty freakishly good. Apparently, according to the rest of the people around me who were like, how the hell did you hear that? That car just pulled up? What? They're outside. Yeah, they're outside. Knock, knock. I told you.
So how have you maintained that with playing on the fabric rig and...
Had the orange earbud things and just not being in the middle of the dance floor.
Well, you've worn those for years.
Yeah, I used to wear them back in the Brace Frontiers days. Really? And shit. Because I discovered you can actually hear so much more of the music when you have little earbuds.
Even with the cheap Tubucca in the ear ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it actually made, like, when with those drum and bass gigs, I would get to the end of the night, and, like, the first couple of times I tried it without protection, and I got to the end of the night, I had that tinnitus. The next day, it's just like, all freaking day. I was like, I can't live like this. And so I started getting those earbuds, or even just making, like, you get, like, 3 cigarette filters and pull them apart and mash them together.
Desperation when I was working at a venue, not as a on the musician side of things, but working at a venue, clearing glasses in Melbourne, I've done toilet paper under the water.
Yep.
Because there's nothing around that night. Yeah, that's interesting you did that back then, because not a lot of people really did. And I actually went to, even though he started playing again, I went to Sean Dean's supposed last gig in Melbourne, and that was while I still lived there. So that must be like 12 years ago, because he'd tinnitus, that's the word, right?
Tinnitus. Tinnitus. Tinnitus.
Yeah. Tinnitus. Had tinnitus, as it did, his ears out and couldn't play anymore, but they must have come right again.
They don't repair.
Well, he's playing again, so he must have figured something out, but you know. You hear about the MDMA study with tinnitus?
Tinnitus. Tinnitus. Tinnitus.
At Auckland Uni? They're administering apparently non... what would be the technical term you'd see in the newspaper? Non-intoxicating doses of MDMA.
Okay.
Because somehow in a laboratory they've early figured out that there may be a link between MDMA as a cure for tinnitus.
Tinnitus. Tinnitus. Tinnitus.
Do you see a delicate irony in that as a study?
Yeah, that's kind of funny. It's like, wow, so we've been protecting ourselves for years.
Yeah.
I always thought it was like hairs break off in there and they can't regrow. Because they're special hairs. But I don't know.
I think that's deafness. But I think tinnitus.
Tinnitus. Tinnitus. Tinnitus.
Is a different thing altogether.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to Google that later.
Okay. So, latest projects?
Let's see. This week, I painted my first motorhome, which you would have seen.
I saw that, and I was sort of glad you're not hooked up with the Wicked Camper people.
Well, I might go and talk to Escape, who are the other Wicked... The other camper van company that don't do the corny, offensive ones.
Right, so not like girls are getting nobbed in the back of this. Yeah.
But Escape do the ones that are quite tasteful and have scenes like that, you know, like good stuff.
Gentle classical music is playing in the boot of this car right now.
And they play, they pay quite nicely for them. But I've also just got heaps of private requests for other vans and stuff, so I'm quite happy to just keep doing that. Today I painted the bonnet of a car at St. Luke's.
So where the heck is this car stuff coming from?
The motorhome came through. Well, he actually seemed to email everyone that I knew that paints, and I was just the one that happened to get onto it first.
Why does a motorhome guy have a mailing list of people he knows who paints?
Well, if you just Google like mural painter or graffiti artist Auckland, then like my mate Johnny is result number one.
Because
I built him this awesome website.
I done this website for him, right? He said, paint the man, right? I said, boom, shaka, let's do it.
I did heaps of work with Donnie. Been a graffiti artist and a mural painter in Auckland for like over a decade. Used to be Pest 5 back in the graffiti days. Now he's Johnny for Hire.
Right, I've seen that name on Facebook, Pest 5, yeah.
Yeah, and his website's like graffiti murals. So he gets heaps of work, and I sort of get his overflow because I'm result number two when you search for Auckland mural artist.
Right.
But I do a lot of work with him as well. So last week I was down in Hamilton for 2 nights with him, doing a couple of kindies down there.
Yeah.
And then today I was painting a car bonnet at St. Luke's as part of the Shave for a Cure for Leukemia and Blood Cancer Research New Zealand.
So now suddenly you're on some kind of like exhibit, Pimp My Ride.
I think so. Yeah.
Yo, dog, I heard you like New Zealand wood pigeons. So we put a New Zealand wood pigeon on your bonnet. So you can...
Wood pigeon while you wood pigeon.
That's great. So what kind of... I mean, and this is another boffin question, but... Because I remember I said to you, the roof on my granny 99 Ford Escort is starting to... Well, it's actually completely gone now. The paint's gone, the open sun.
Yeah.
And you said, should we paint it up? And I thought to myself, well, how would that work in terms of... what kind of paint do you use on a car that won't look whack a month or two later if you're not actually, you know, a dude who spray coats cars one colour? Well, the paint, how do you do it so it stays?
The paint that I used, Belton make a paint called Molitor, was actually first developed as a vehicle paint.
Right.
And graffiti artists were attracted to it because it has such a range of colours. They have like 250 colours.
Right.
Because you need to have a lot of colours if you want to have paint for cars.
Yeah.
And graffiti artists like a lot of colours. And you can't mix spray cans like you can with acrylic paint. So if you want to have a colour, you've got to have that colour in a can.
Yeah.
And this paint's really hard wearing, high UV resistance and lots of colour pigmentation.
So you don't need to put anything on it.
Well, it depends. I mean, this stuff is matte. So if you want a gloss paint, you get a gloss paint. Otherwise, if you get a matte paint, you want to do a varnish, a lacquer layer, but that stuff gets... Like, you need body shops to do proper...
I think the kind of feel and style of your art suits matte on a car rather than gloss. Yeah. Gloss to me is like...
Oh, thanks, dude. No one's ever said that to me before.
Well, I think gloss to me is more like you would have done like a photoreal tiger with a chick in a bikini lying over the tiger.
You do know what I mean by gloss and matte. It's just like the reflectiveness of the paint. Yeah, yeah.
So you said you choose matte.
The paint that I use happens to be matte.
Yeah.
And I sometimes put an acrylic.
But if it was gloss, it'd be shiny, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think it's that far apart.
Eh?
I don't think it's that far apart. But no, okay.
Yeah.
I'll go with you there. Yeah, and you can get gloss ones. I think like the I think Iron Lac is gloss, and there are certain brands that are all glossy. And if you're painting a car, gloss generally looks better. But matte is quite trendy now. That matte black finish on cars.
Yeah, that kind of that gunmetal grey.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. They're pretty cool. It's gone.
So I'm
it's beyond just being a primer thing. So yeah,
if you want a glossy, shiny.
If you
want
to get your car pimped out, then come see me with like two rolls of masking tape one weekend and a bottle of booze.
No, hear me now. So with your bonnet, you know, if you were painting a tiger with a woman in a bikini draped over it on that car, surely that would lend itself to gloss before matte.
It's funny that you say that.
Whereas if you're painting like you are the native pigeon on a whatever bush, surely that's matte.
Well, as you can see from this picture, not you people on the microphone, but we're Lewis in the real space
that's
here.
That's beautiful.
The background is matte and the cat is gloss.
Oh, so now you're telling me you mix,
I use both. Because for a brush, if you want to use a brush.
Yeah. But if all of it was gloss, it would look... It would look gaudy, Paul. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, no, I probably would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the point I was making.
Yes, no, I agree.
Yeah. But you said, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I like to humour you sometimes.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah, so that's and then this afternoon, after painting that cat on the bonnet of a car at St. Luke's and giving Hilary Barry a sweaty hug, she's lovely.
She is.
TV people, man, they're weird. It's like you see them in person, it's like, wow, it's a TV person in the world.
You know, you don't really watch TV, do you? But I had this young woman, Verity Johnson, here, who I spotted on Paul Henry, and I thought, wow, she's a real star, but in terms of how banal mainstream media is a lot of the time, she kind of dressed a little differently to everyone else on Paul Henry's show. She was kind of like not afraid to say what the hell she thought. Had her in. But yes, TV people are different. And she looked different.
What was I going to say? Oh, yes. And then this afternoon, I went and painted over Leonard Cohen's face on the side of the rock shop.
Oh, what's it changed to?
It's going to be, I'm going to be there at 9 a.m. tomorrow painting Chuck Berry.
Wow. And so, like with Bill Cosby, you're prepared to overlook his shenanigans as a legend?
Yeah.
Oh, good stuff.
No, well, first one I painted was John Lennon. He was an arsehole too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, Chuck Berry is the original wild man of rock and roll. There's a reason that rock and roll has the reputation of, like, wild man party time music.
Totally.
And Chuck Berry's part of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, he's the origin.
The genesis.
The genesis of that. That's right. And if you want to put some cameras in your diner 30, 40 years later, I'd just say, get involved. That's what I say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it goes to most music, you know, like...
Look, that's right. I jest, you know. Yeah. No one's...
I listen to hip-hop perfect. All the time.
Yeah. So what does that mean?
Tupac and Biggie, they're both assholes.
Tupac Shakur. Tupac Shakur. Tupac Shakur.
Do we have the correct pronunciation of your name?
What do you say specifically, Alison Tipper?
Oh, like they actually...
You hone in on Biggie and Tupac.
Tupac Shakur. Tupac Shakur. Tupac Shakur.
Do we have the correct pronunciation of your name?
Of all the assholes in hip-hop, why Biggie and...
Oh, they're just lauded as being like the greatest MCs of all time. Like, yeah, people put them in the top five consistently, and they both have criminal records of beating and raping women. And
I don't know that. Too, I thought Tupac was like a struggling actor. That
he spent jail in time for sexual assault.
Did he?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it was alleged that he wasn't one of the actual ones getting involved, but he was there and was complicit, and yada yada. I mean, I don't know how guilty he actually was. Could have just been all the setup, but
it wasn't just like a black man in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I mean, there's that as well. Yeah, yeah. But I think that, I mean, the record industries have, I think that they have an agenda when they promote artists who tend to be violent, especially when it comes to black Americans.
You just made me think about the one that did my head in. Okay, so it's hip hop, but it's just music in general. It's just people I look to in general. Was KRS-One's response to the Bambaataa thing, because whether or not the Bambaataa thing's true or not, I thought KRS-One's response was really exposed him as someone really different to everything I'd ever thought about him, because I really believed that he was this person he said he was, and then he sort of came out and was just another close-minded, blinkered, protect my turf kind of, like, don't worry about the victim if this is true asshole. I don't know how big, I mean, I don't know about you, I have historically been a really huge KRS-One fan. Like, he's actually one of my big
Return of the Boom Bap is one of the greatest albums of all time.
Stop it, people don't even mention it. It's killer. Every track is killer.
Yeah.
But aside from that music thing, you know, like that art versus the joke I made about Chuck Berry, in between that, KRS-One's thing, it's kind of like Cosby-esque now I think about it. It's like that whole, like, holier thing, you know, temple of hip-hop, da-da-da-da-da-da. And I thought the way he came out about that Bambaataa thing, it troubled me. I don't know. What do you do? Well, do you actually believe those allegations?
Yeah.
Why do you believe them? Did you get in deep in research and stuff?
Oh, I read enough of the guy's stories, and there didn't seem to be anything for him to gain from putting them out there, because they'd passed the statute of limitations anyway. So I was like, why would he be putting
these out there? It's like this is affecting my life, and I need to talk about it.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is terrible. It's like they say, No, I won't say that. I was going to say, you know, in hindsight, Bam is kind of an odd fellow.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, a lot of artists do have really troubled lives and may have fucked up views or something.
No, you can't. Don't peg that.
A lot of
assault,
humans.
You can't peg that assault of other things on artists. That's not where we're going to end.
No.
A lot of humans. Are fucked.
A lot of humans
are
fucked.
Frail.
Up. Yeah.
You know, and how do you weed out the good ones from the bad ones? But my point with the KRS-One thing is, you know, he should not have. He felt like he was protecting his business or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think he was so involved in the hip hop culture and the temple of hip hop that he sort of, to have a central figure like Bambaataa being sort of cast out like that would have been really hard for him. You know, judging his allegiance to the art form, to actually caring about the people that were abused,
and also a lot of those hip hop artists struggle with the gay thing to begin with, so there's that as well. It's like you're calling out a man, you know, as a sexuality you're not comfortable with. I think it goes quite deep.
Man, I've really had to become aware of that in the last 5 years.
What's that?
Having two kids. How much I like rap music and how much they swear. Oh, God. Oh, Lordy.
Swearing's fine, but it's all about the hatred of other people.
It's just when your kids start repeating lyrics and asking you what they mean, it's like, okay, maybe I shouldn't be playing this song at 8 o'clock in the morning as I'm dropping you off at kindy if you're actually listening to the lyrics.
I can see like you're pulling up to kindy like windows down, suspension, straight out of Compton.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Hug the police.
Right, we'll leave it there. This has been a, because I've had such a long day, it's been such a pleasure you've come in. It's been a long day, and I think it's been really non-sequitur.
Yeah, sorry I had to do it late, man.
But I think this will bear strange fruit. Strange fruits. I love you, man.
Oh, thanks, Lewis. Love you too, man.
Oh,